In the early morning, Buckart heard the honey guide. It was fluttering in the treetops, chittering and uttering that particular whirring sound that could mean only one thing. His mouth watered.
"I greet you, my sweet friend," he called,
and ran to stand beneath the tree in which the drab little bird was performing its seductive gyrations. Its movements became more frenzied when it saw that it had attracted Buckart's attention. It left the branch on which it was displaying and flitted to the next tree. Buckart hesitated and glanced round at the square of wagons lagered at the edge of the forest on the far side of the glade a mile away. If he were to take the time to run back merely to tell Samoya where he was going, the bird might become discouraged and fly away before he returned. Samoya might forbid him to follow it. Buckart smacked his lips. He could almost taste the sweet, viscous honey on his tongue. He lusted for it.
"I will not be away long," he consoled himself. "Samoya will not even know that I am gone. He and Walenga are probably playing with their little wooden dolls."
This was Buckart's opinion of the carved chessmen that so often occupied the couple to the exclusion of everything around them. Buckart ran after the bird. The honey guide saw him coming and sang to him as it flitted onto the next tree, then the next. Buckart sang as he followed.
"You lead me to sweetness, and I love you for it. You are more beautiful than the sunbird, wiser than the owl, greater than the eagle. You are the lord of all birds."
Which was not true, but the honey guide would be flattered to hear it. Buckart ran through the forest for the rest of that morning. And in the noonday, when the forest sweltered in the heat and all the animals and birds were silent and somnolent, the bird stopped at last in the top branches of a tambuti tree and changed its melody. Buckart understood what it was telling him.
"We have arrived. This is the place of the hive, and it overflows with golden honey. Now you and I will eat our fill."
Buckart stood beneath the tambuti and threw back his head as he peered upwards. He saw the bees, highlighted by the low sunlight like golden dust motes as they darted into the cleft in the tree trunk. Buckart took from his shoulder his bow and quiver, his axe and leather carrying bag. He laid them carefully at the base of the tree. The honey guide would understand that this was his guarantee that he would return. However, to make certain there was no misunderstanding, Buckart explained to the bird.
"Wait for me here, my little friend. I will not be gone long. I must gather the vine to lull the bees."
He found the plant he needed growing on the bank of a nearby stream. It climbed the trunk of a leadwood tree, wrapping round it like a slender serpent. The leaves were shaped like teardrops and the tiny flowers were scarlet. Buckart was gentle as he harvested the leaves he needed, careful not to damage the plant more than he had to, for it was a precious thing. To kill it would be a sin against nature and his own people, the San. With the wad of leaves in his pouch, he moved on until he reached a grove of fever trees. He picked out one whose trunk was the right girth for his needs and ring-barked it. Then he peeled off a section and rolled it into a tube, which he secured with twists of bark string. He ran back to the honey tree. When the bird saw him return, it burst into hysterical chitterings of relief. Buckart squatted at the foot of the tree and made a tiny fire inside the bark tube. He blew into one end to create a draught, and the coals glowed hotly. He scattered a few of the flowers and the leaves of the vine onto them. As they smouldered, they emitted clouds of pungent smoke. Buckart stood up, hooked the blade of the axe over his shoulder, and began to climb the tree. He went up as swiftly as a vervet monkey. Just below the cleft in the trunk, he found a convenient branch and took a seat on it. He sniffed the waxy odour of the hive and listened for a moment to the deep, murmurous voice of the swarm in the depths of the hollow trunk. He studied the entrance to the hive and marked his first cut, then placed one end of the bark tube into the opening and gently blew puffs of the smoke into it. After a while, the humming of the swarm fell into silence, as the bees were sedated and lulled. Buckart laid aside the smoke tube and braced himself, balancing easily on the narrow branch. He swung the axe. As the blow reverberated through the trunk, a few bees came out and buzzed around his head, but the smoke of the vine leaves had dulled their warlike instincts. One or two stung him, but Buckart ignored them. With quick, powerful axe strokes, he cut a square hatchway in the hollow trunk and exposed the serried ranks of honeycombs. Then he climbed down to the ground and laid aside the axe. He returned to his perch on the branch with the leather bag over his shoulder. He scattered more vine leaves on the coals in the fire tube and blew clouds of the thick, pungent smoke into the enlarged entrance. When the swarm was silent again, he reached deep into the hive. With bees flowing over his arms and shoulders, he lifted out the combs, one at a time, and laid them gently in the bag. When the hive was empty, he thanked the bees for their bounty and apologized to them for his cruel treatment.
"Very soon you will recover from the smoke I have given you, and you will be able to repair your hive and fill it once again with honey. Bakat will always be your friend, and he feels only great respect and gratitude towards you," he told the bees.
He climbed down to the ground and cut a curl of bark from the trunk of the tambuti tree to form a tray on which he could lay out the honey guide's share of the booty. He selected the choicest comb for his little friend and accomplice, one that was full of the yellow grubs, for he knew the bird loved these almost as much as he did. He gathered up all his possessions and slung the bulging leather bag over his shoulder. For the last time he thanked the bird and bade it farewell. As soon as he stepped back, the bird dropped down from the top of the tree, fell upon the fat golden comb, and pecked out the juicy grubs at once. Bakat smiled and watched it indulgently for a while. He knew he would eat it all, even the wax, for it was the only creature that was able to digest this part of the bounty. He reminded the little bird of the legend of the greedy San who had cleaned out the hive and left nothing for the bird. The next time the bird had led him to a hole in the trunk of a tree in which was coiled a huge black mamba. The snake stung the cheating sand to death.
"The next time we meet, remember that I treated you well and fairly," Bakat told the bird. "I will look for you again. May the Nkulukulu watch over you."
And he set off back towards the wagons. As he went, he reached into the bag, broke off pieces of comb, and stuffed them into his mouth, humming with deep pleasure. Within half a mile he stopped abruptly at a crossing place on the stream, and stared in astonishment at the prints of human feet in the clay of the bank. The people who had passed this way recently had made no effort to hide their tracks. They were San. Bakat's heart leapt like a gazelle. Only when he saw the fresh footprints did he realize how he had pined for his own people. He examined the sign avidly. There were five of them, two men and three women. One man was old and the other much younger. He divined this from the reach and alacrity of their separate strides. One of the women was ancient and hobbled along on gnarled, twisted feet. Another was in her prime, with a strong, determined step. She led the Indian file of her family. Then Bakat's eyes fell on the fifth and last set of prints, and he felt a great longing squeeze his heart. They were dainty and as enchanting as any of the paintings of the artists of his tribe. Bakat felt that he might weep with the beauty of them. He had to sit down for a while and stare at one until he could recover from the effect that they had had upon him. In his mind's eye he could see the girl who had left these signs for him to find. He divined with all his instincts that she was very young, but graceful, limber, and nubile. Then he stood up again and followed her footprints into the forest. On the far bank of the stream he came to the point where the two men had separated from the women and gone off among the trees to hunt. From that point the women had begun gathering the wild harvest of the veld. Bakat saw where they had broken off the fruit from the branches, and dug out the edible tubers and roots with the sharp pointed stakes that each carried. He followed the tracks that the girl had left, and saw how swiftly and surely she worked. She made no false digs, wasting no effort, and it was clear to Bakat that she knew every plant and tree she came upon. She passed by the poisonous and tasteless, and picked out the sweet and nourishing. Bakat giggled with admiration. "Hey, this is a clever little one. She could feed her whole family with what she has gathered since she crossed the stream. What a wife she would make for a man!" Then he heard voices in the forest ahead, feminine voices calling to each other as they worked. One was as musical and sweet as the call of the oriole. that golden songster of the high galleries of the forest. It led him as irresistibly as the honey guide had. Silent and unseen, he crept towards the girl. She was working in a clump of thick scrub. He could hear her digging stick thudding into the earth. At last he was close enough to make out her movements, veiled by the latticework of branches and leaves. Then, suddenly, she moved into the open directly in front of Bucket. All the solitary years and loneliness were swept away like debris in the new surging flow of his emotions. She was exquisite, tiny and perfect. Her skin glowed in the noonday sunlight. Her face was a golden flower. Her lips were full and petal-shaped. She lifted one graceful hand and, with her thumb, wiped the clinging drops of perspiration from her arched eyebrow and flicked them away. They sparkled as they flew through the air. He was so close that one splashed on his dusty shin. She was oblivious of his presence and began to walk away. Then one of the other women called to her from nearby, "Are you thirsty, Letty? Shall we go back to the stream?" The girl stopped and looked back. She wore only a tiny leather apron in front, decorated with cowrie shells and beads made from chippings of ostrich eggshell. The pattern of the shells and beads proclaimed that she was a virgin, and that no man had yet spoken for her.
"My mouth is as dry as a desert stone. Let us go," Letty laughed as she replied to her mother. Her teeth were small and very white.
In that moment, Bucket's entire existence changed. As she walked away, her little breasts joggled merrily, and her plump, naked buttocks undulated. He made no attempt to stop or delay her. He knew that he could find her again anywhere and at any time. When she had disappeared, he stood up slowly from his hiding place. Suddenly he gave a leap of joy high into the air and rushed away to make himself a love arrow. He selected a perfect reed from the edge of the stream and lavished upon it all his talents as an artist. He painted it with mystic patterns and designs. The colours he chose from his paint horns were yellow, white, red, and black. He fledged it with the purple feathers of the lowry and padded the tip with a ball of tanned springbuck skin stuffed with sunbird feathers so that it would inflict no pain or injury on Letty.
"It is beautiful,"
Bucket admired his own handiwork when it was finished.
"But not as beautiful as Letty."
That night he found the encampment of Letty's family. They were temporarily inhabiting a cave in the rocky cliff above the stream. He crept close in the darkness and listened to their banal, inconsequential chatter. From it he learned that the old man and woman were her grandparents, and the other couple her mother and father. Her elder sister had recently found herself a fine husband and left the clan. The others were teasing Letty. She had seen her first menstrual moonrise fully 3 months previously, yet she was still a virgin and unmarried. Letty hung her head in shame at her failure to find herself a man. Bucket left the mouth of the cave and found a place to sleep further down the stream. But he was back before dawn, and when the women left the cave to go out into the forest, he followed them at a discreet distance. When they started to forage, they kept in touch with each other by calling and whistling. But after a while, Letty became separated from them. Bucket closed in on her with all his stalking skills. She was digging for the fat tuber of the tiski plant, a variety of wild manioc. She kept her legs straight as she bent over and rocked to the rhythm of her digging stick. The protruding lips of her sex peeped out from between the backs of her thighs, and her plump little rear end was pointed to the sky. Bucket crept close. His hands shook as he raised the tiny ceremonial bow and aimed his love arrow. Yet his aim was true as ever, and Letty squeaked with surprise and sprang high in the air as the arrow smacked into her bottom. She wheeled round, clutching herself with both hands, her expression betraying her astonishment and outrage. Then she saw the arrow lying at her feet and gazed around her at the silent bush. Bucket had disappeared like a puff of smoke. The stinging in her bottom abated as she rubbed it. Then slowly she was overcome with shyness. Suddenly, Bucket appeared so close that she gasped with shock. She stared at him. His chest was broad and deep. His legs and arms were sturdy. She saw at an instant, by the easy way in which he bore his weapons, that he was a mighty hunter and that he would provide well for a family. He carried the colour pots of the artist on his belt, which meant that he would have high standing and much prestige within all the tribes of the San. She dropped her eyes demurely and whispered,
"You are so tall.
I saw you from afar."
"I also saw you from afar," Bakat replied, "for your beauty lights the forest like the rising of the sun."
"I knew you would come," she answered him, "for your face was painted on my heart on the day of my birth."
Letty came forward timidly, took his hand and led him to her mother. In her other hand she carried the love arrow.
"This is Bakat," she told her mother, and held up the arrow.
Her mother shrieked, which brought the grandmother running, cackling like a hen guinea fowl. The two older women went ahead of them to the cave, singing, dancing and clapping. Bakat and Letty followed them, still holding hands. Bakat gave Letty's grandfather the bag of wild honey. He could not have brought them a more acceptable gift. Not only were they all addicted to the sweetness, but it proved Bakat's ability to provide for a wife and children. The family feasted on it, but Bakat ate none because he was the giver. With every mouthful, Letty smacked her lips and smiled at him. They talked until late in the light of the campfire. Bakat told them who he was, the totem of his tribe, and the list of his ancestors. The grandfather knew many of them, and clapped his hands as he recognized their names. Letty sat with the other women, and they did not join in the talk of the men. At last, Letty stood up and crossed to where Bakat sat between the other two men. She took his hand and led him to where she had laid out her sleeping mat at the back of the cave. The two left early in the morning. All Letty's possessions were packed into the roll of her sleeping mat, and she carried it balanced effortlessly on her head. Bakat went ahead of her. They moved at a trot, a pace they could keep up from morning until evening. Bakat sang the hunting songs of his tribe as he ran, and Letty joined in the chorus in her sweet, childlike voice.